Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nicholas C., the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Professor Haag about his new book, The Eastern Frontier, Limits of Empire in Late Antique and Early Medieval Central Asia, published by Abi Torres. Rob, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Nick.
Yeah, and Professor Haag received his BA in Geography in Geography and History from DePaul University in 1999. His MA is in Modern Middle Eastern and North African Studies from the University of Michigan, which he earned in 2002. And he also earned his PhD in Near Eastern Studies, also from the University of Michigan in 2010. And correct me if I'm wrong, this book, The Eastern Frontier, is actually, it comes from that dissertation that you did while at the University of Michigan. Is that correct?
Yes, in a sense. So my PhD dissertation was called The Gate of Iron, The Making of the Eastern Frontier. And it was a study of this kind of Central Asian frontier of primarily, in that case, the Abbasid Caliphate, working very closely with a collection of medieval geographical texts, mostly written in Arabic. And that took a much more kind of thematic approach. I had a chapter on, for example, types of fortifications and a chapter on numismatics and things like that. The book, in contrast, takes a much more kind of chronological approach. So it is a very different project, even though they both started with the same, you know, in the same place. There's not much of the dissertation left in the book.
So in doing the research for the book, you've kind of turned it into a new project. You mentioned that in the dissertation, you were working primarily with travel texts or geographical texts. What kind of new materials did you bring when you were doing the postdoctoral research for the book?
Well, there's a lot of different things, new materials I had to bring in there. One big change in the book, for example, is that I felt that in order to approach this topic, I needed to step back from the Islamic era and include, for example, a whole chapter on this frontier of Central Asia during the Sasanian period. And that required me to look at, obviously, all the sources we have available for the Sasanian Empire, get involved in the different kinds of numismatics and the kind of limited sources we have for late antique Central Asia for the Hephthalites and Turks and Sogdians, you know, where we do have very limited number of sources available to us. So bringing those materials in, I also tried to incorporate more archaeology, though maybe not as successfully as I hoped to kind of fill this out, but you know, the main thing was moving away from just this kind of these geographical sources, bringing in more of the chronicles and local histories and things like this in order to focus more on this chronological narrative of the development of the frontier.
And before we get into the meat of the book, really, I wanted to ask you, how did you Why did you get interested in Central Asia, specifically in medieval Central Asia? Was this your original research focus, or, you know, could you describe a little bit about how you came to this topic? Because it's you know, there's an argument here specifically about the Eastern frontier and its role in these bigger empires. So that tells me that maybe you were once looking at the history of Baghdad or something like that.
Well, I often say when people ask me how I got interested in medieval Central Asia, that it was really a series of accidents over a course of you know, probably about, you know, over the course of my you know, kind of academic career. I started off, you know, when I got interested in history, I'd always been interested in history, but when I started to major in history, for example, I knew I didn't necessarily want to work on Western history, and I kind of shopped around, took a few classes here and there, and got pulled towards the Islamic world as a result, primarily the result of a study abroad opportunity as an undergrad to Morocco. When I did my master's degree, I was working on more kind of 18th, 19th century North African history. I was working with Juan Cole at Michigan, and wrote my thesis on the Mokhtis revolt in Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, and was very interested in the role of the slave trade in there. But along that way, I met Michael Bonner, who became my PhD advisor. He had me come in as I was learning Arabic and start reading medieval texts with him. Particularly, our first reading course was reading these geographical texts. And these texts are, you know, not traveler's tales, but some of our administrative geographies. Some of them are more what we might think of, you know, humanist geographies, right? That talking about different places and characteristics of the people you'd find there and certain sites you might see and things like this. And getting engaged in the text, right, really pulled me into earlier and earlier periods. And when I started the PhD, I really wanted to work on these materials. And I was thinking of working on something more kind of Baghdad focused, more kind of central Islamic lands focused. But as I was doing my coursework and doing readings, I started getting really interested in the breakdown of the Abbasid Empire. And it's in the east, in places like Khorasan and Central Asia, where you're finding these autonomous dynasties that start kind of falling away from the empire at its fringes. And I got really interested in this dynamic and looking at these groups and their relationship to the political centers in Iraq. And that's what pulled me towards these questions of the frontier. And it also didn't, you know, hurt that my advisor had worked quite a bit on frontiers himself. He published quite a bit on the Arab-Byzantine frontier.
Right.
So this is the kind of interest that we could get involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really comes through in this book. I mean, it seems to be the main argument of the book is bringing this geographical approach to the Eastern frontier. And what I wanted to ask about, because this comes up in the first chapter in which you're trying to conceptualize the Eastern frontier in this medieval geography is, first, if you could explain what this term shatter zone means, and also if you could talk to briefly, you know, it seems like borderlands, the history of borderlands has become a really popular or topic, whether in modern history, but, and this could just be my ignorance, I haven't heard much of people looking at medieval history using these kind of borderland approaches. So is this the novelty of the book? Is this what you're bringing to the table? And I'm wondering where you pulled this kind of thinking about borderlands and decided to bring it to the medieval history of Central Asia in order to tell us a more compelling story about the Abbasids and even the Sasanians, I think. You know, we get a really rich history, but it's a history that might be unfamiliar to even experts who have spent time studying these different empires. So could you talk a little bit about what inspired you to develop these theories about how the frontier kind of operated in within these empires.
Yeah, so there is quite a bit of scholarship out there about medieval borderlands, medieval frontiers. But a lot of it is kind of situated in certain places. There's also a lot on ancient borders and frontiers, right? There's a lot on the Roman frontiers, for example, and working on the dissertation, that was something I had to read very closely, right, as a point of comparison. But you find things, you know, topics like, for example, medieval Spain, right, is a place where there's a lot of work on borderlands, people studying, the kind of competition between Christian and Islamic kingdoms, right, the Reconquista, though people don't always like that term, was going forward, right? So places like that, in certain locations, there are these great studies where people have really effectively approached this. And I wanted to kind of bring some of this to a frontier that had received less attention, right? In general, the eastern part of the Islamic world, the eastern part of the Iranian world in general, if we bring in the Sasanian era too, receives a lot less attention. Part of that is because we don't have a lot of sources from the area. We have to rely on sources that are written in Iraq, sources that are written not only remote in geography, but also remote in time, right? So when you're looking at the chapters, for example, my book about the Arab conquest of Central Asia, I'm relying on a lot of chronicles that are written 200, 300 years after the event, right? Or at least compiled, 200, 300 years after the events they're discussing. So this puts a lot of kind of challenges there, right? So I'm trying to look at an area of the world and a period of time that's not very well studied, bringing these some of these ideas that are developed for other frontiers, for other borderlands, to the fore here. Now, with that in mind, Central Asia is obviously its own unique thing, right? You can't just import theories about the Roman Empire or theories about medieval Spain and put them directly on medieval Central Asia, right? And one of the things you brought up the term shatter zone, and I think one of the things that's very important that needs to be pushed forward is that the way we kind of imagine a frontier, right, doesn't quite work for a place like Central Asia, a place that is divided up by very high rugged mountains, divided up by very harsh and dry deserts, right? That you have these kind of oases and these urban centers that a lot of times are isolated from each other by that very geography. So we don't have the kind of, say, image think of an animated map. For example, we've all seen like an animated GIF map of something like the Mongol Empire expanding, right? Or westward expansion in the U.S. And you see a blob that just kind of evenly moves out across a space, right? That's not really what will work in a place like Central Asia, in which what you're really probably seeing are little nodes, little dots that are being captured or being brought under a certain kind of political authority, usually brought under, political authority means they're paying taxes, right, to an empire. But it's not this kind of broad stretch. It would be these little kind of places that are isolated from each other. The other problem is a lot of times when we talk about borderland studies and frontier studies, we get these theories about the mixing of different cultures and different peoples at the fringes of empires or at the places where two different states interact, right, and meet. But the kind of divided nature of the geography of the region means that there is a lot of smaller varieties of groups that are interacting, that are overlapping with each other. And you don't get that same kind of melding of the borderland that, say, a lot of studies today of say, the U.S.-Mexico border, or, a lot of these ideas came out of studies of the German-French border in the 19th century and things like that, that you don't get that same kind of sense. So it takes, you're required to, like, look at these theories, but make your own, kind of a adaptions to meet the local terrain.
And so, thank you for that. When you're looking at this region, you've kind of divided the kind of eastern frontier into three sections that kind of run throughout the course of the book, whether we're looking at the Sasanian period or the Abbasids or even after, which are Khorasan, Transoxiana, and Tukhoristan. The last one, which I have heard way less of, could you briefly define those regions geographically? And then tell us, you're looking at basically the end of, I think, the 6th century up until about the 10th or 11th century. Do you see that these are fixed geographical spaces that are recognizable throughout these sources, or are they also kind of in flux throughout this period?
Yeah. That's a very good question. It seems like they're easy questions to say how do you define certain provinces of an empire or a region, right? It's never so, neat and clean, right? And medieval scholars and modern scholars debate a lot about the precise boundaries of each of these regions. So what I've done for this project to keep a level of consistency here is I've defined Khorasan as the eastern province of the Sasanian Empire. And I put its limits kind of at the kind of typical extent of the Sasanian Empire. So for me, that is kind of the area south of the Oxus, right? Which is typically what you're going to find are a lot of people who divide the region between, what's south of the Oxus and what's north of the Oxus, right? What's Khorasan and what's, Transoxiana. But here, I see it also an important division that Khorasan maybe does not extend all as far east as, say, Greater Khorasan as a province of the Abbasid Caliphate would extend, right? So I stop it at the Morghab River around the important city of Marv-el-Rud. So pretty much kind of at the border of modern Afghanistan around there, maybe a little further east. Tukharistan then is pretty close to ancient Bactria, right? Centered on the city of Balkh. And it would be the area kind of north of the Hindu Kush and actually extends kind of over the Oxus a little bit and comes up to the area where there's the kind of mountains, the high mountains that are difficult to pass and make a kind of natural border. Then Transoxiana is very, kind of easier to define as those areas north of the Oxus River. But the northern limits of what counts as Transoxiana are typically politically defined, right? So in the early Islamic period, Transoxiana extends as far as the reach of the caliphate, for example, or its successor states.
And so as far as I understand, the majority of the book is looking at how these frontiers were changing based on what was happening within the Abbasid Caliphate. So to get into that, could you briefly describe what Central Asia and specifically these three regions that you define looked like at the end of the Sasanian period? And then how does this, do we see any kind of change locally based on what's happening, further west or further east in China? Mm-hmm. I know that there are Turks coming into the region around this time. So can you give us a sense for what's happening on this eastern frontier as, on the eve of the Arab conquest?
So to put it very simply, you think of Khorasan as being that kind of eastern province of the Sasanian Empire that was fairly consistently, though not always, under control of the empire. I start off the chapter on the Sasanians with the kind of great Hephthalite victory over the Shahanshah Piruz the First back in the 5th century. And this, kind of, there is a period around this in which Khorasan falls out of Sasanian control. They recapture it. It seems to be, kind of very loosely in the empire at times. But the argument I would make is that it's probably more important to think of certain urban nodes as being within the empire, and then kind of putting a frontier up to defend against forces beyond. Throughout the Sasanian period, there's a series of peoples who kind of come into the region, right? The kind of most prominent, important, the largest figures who are going to play a role into the Islamic era would be, of course, the Hephthalites, an Iranian nomadic group who come to dominate Turkmenistan and Transoxiana. Then after the Turks arrive, kind of bring themselves, focus themselves more in Turkmenistan. In Transoxiana, you have a number of Sogdian city-states, right? The Sogdians being kind of better known popularly for their role in the quote-unquote Silk Road trade. But you have cities like Bukhara and Samarkand being the most famous as kind of autonomous kingdoms that are under some kind of Turkish authority. We're not sure what that means. Some people have made arguments that, for example, that the Turkic presence in Sogdiana might have really just been kind of a military mercenary type of arrangement, but some kind of connection there. So you have really at the outset of this, a kind of imperial zone in Khorasan, and then beyond that, some kind of loosely, you know, construed kingdoms, Hephthalite, Turkish, Sogdian, that are on the fringes. Most of the book, then, the bulk of the book, has to deal with the kind of replacement of the Sasanian Empire with the Islamic Caliphate and the process of expanding that caliphate into Tukharistan and Transoxiana and bringing these regions into a kind of imperial framework and what that does to the region, how that transforms the frontier.
And the first thing that, after the Arab conquest, the first thing that happens basically is the caliphate uses this region to line their coffers, right? Like they show very little interest in claiming these lands, but they're interested in kind of looting the place and then using it to build up their treasury. Is that right? Or am I simplifying that too much?
Maybe a slight simplification. One of the things that's important to remember is that in the early years of the caliphate, the Arab and Muslim population across the entire empire is very thin, right? They are a kind of extreme minority ruling over, this large, vast empire, very diverse empire, right? And when you look at the conquest of Iran, for example, which the conquest of Central Asia is an extension of, early on, you have forces that are stationed in two newly found cities in Iraq, of Basra and Kufa. And forces are sent out from these cities on an annual basis, and they tend to kind of return back to Iraq after a campaign season. Shortly after first appearing in Central Asia, you do have the establishment of a Arab garrison in the city of Marv in modern Turkmenistan. But this is also a very small garrison. And it seems like as people are conquering regions, that they are returning now to Marv at the end of a campaign season. So you have regular raids, for example, into Sogdiana, to cities like Bukhara. You have raids into Turkmenistan, reaching Balkh. They come, they demand submission, which means payment of tribute, payment of a tax, and then they leave and go back to these kind of centers where they can kind of focus themselves. And there's a number of reasons why this is happening, why they aren't kind of settling more broadly, but the most important being that they are a very small population comparative to the people they are interacting with and conquering. So over time, though, this presence kind of spreads out a little bit more. And probably more importantly, a greater part of the local population will convert to Islam, and the kind of culture of the empire will start expanding into these frontier zones. But initially, yes, there's little that can be done other than a kind of attack, demand tribute, demand taxes, then leave, and then come back the next year and ask for the taxes again.
And as far as I can understand, there's a sort of culture of resistance, right? Especially beyond the inner part of Khorasan, as this empire moves further northeast. And at one point, I think in the book, you even referred to geographers talking about this region being a sort of wild, wild east. Of course, I don't think that was the term they would have used, but yeah. And I'm wondering, could you explain that a little bit more? You know, I was compelled by this idea of the wild, wild east, because you get some of these stories, for instance, Musa's taking of the city of Termez. I wonder if a bit of this was exaggerated, or what are we really seeing in these sources, which were a couple hundred years after the said events? And why do we end up with this image of these different regions as kind of the wild frontier?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. And first of all, I think traditionally there's been a reading of the conquest of Central Asia that says it describes it as following a process of capture, rebellion, recapture, right? And read these resistances by local powers as a form of rebellion against Arab rule. And this has often been used in the past to kind of make an almost nationalist argument that the people of Eastern Iran, of Central Asia, stood up against empire. My take on it in the book is a little bit more to think about the realities of what the Arabs were doing in these conquests, that it wasn't really rebellion. They left. Right, they didn't make a permanent settlement in all these places they conquered. They would reconsolidate in these kind of central garrisons. Right, what do you do in the meantime when nobody's there? Right, you don't pay taxes unless somebody comes up and asks for them. Right. Now, a second aspect of this is that, whereas, say, the Sasanian Empire, the political structures, the military structures of that were kind of completely destroyed by the caliphate, or co-opted more appropriately by the caliphate. And that's kind of one of the arguments I make of what makes Khorasan different from Tokaristan and Transoxiana, is that the Arabs are able to latch on to this kind of imperial geography of the Sasanian Empire and employ that, right? And people are used to this kind of structure. When you get out to Tokaristan and Transoxiana, there are competing kind of sources of authority that are trying to claim this area as well. So in Tokaristan, you have, if the Arabs come to Balkh, for example, and they demand taxes and they demand tribute and they go away, maybe the next week some Hephthalites come down from the mountains and demand taxes as well, right? Is that rebellion? Is that resistance? Right, it's just a kind of a reality of being in a frontier zone with kind of weak political control. When you get to Sogdiana, you have these city states that are caught between the caliphate, which is trying to expand but not able to really make that leap across the river and secure a position for several decades, against a Turkic Kaikanate, which is coming down from the north and it's having its going through its own kind of political struggles. And one of the things I wanted to make clear in the book is that you can follow the kind of highs and lows of the Turks and match that up with moments of success and moments of kind of retreat in the Arabs, that there was these kind of alternative empires, right? Especially when you talk about the Turks, a steppe empire that were competing for the space as well. It wasn't the caliphate kind of going beyond the borders of the Sasanian Empire into some kind of free land, as I think some people have imagined it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But then the political situation in the heartland, the kind of western part of the new caliphate, also impacts what happens on the border, right? So with the... I'd like to you to go into a little bit detail about this, but the second fitna, what is that, and how does this change the way that the rule looks on the eastern frontier? Especially as we move along, and I want to focus specifically on who becomes the problem. Is it the locals, or is it these rulers who are being sent out to these regions and then kind of get a sense of power, and they're actually the ones that are not operating in the interest of the empire as a whole. Is that right?
Well, that's a bit of the story, right? So one of the problems that the caliphate faces early on in these conquests, that shortly after you have the first kind of Arab incursions into Khorasan, not even quite yet into Tokharistan or Transoxiana in any real way, the caliphate falls into a period of civil war called the First Fitna, which people might be familiar with. This is the kind of where the whole narrative of the Sunni-Shi split is often described as starting, even though I disagree with that. There's a fight over kind of succession of the caliphate itself. Okay. And this attracts a lot of attention. And if you think of these troops kind of rotating back to Iraq all the time, they're going back, and instead of going to conquer more, they are staying local to fight this civil war. Then a few decades later, as things are, kind of calming down, and there's preparations for another big push into Transoxiana, a second civil war, the second fitna, breaks down, really over questions about whether or not the caliphate would become a hereditary title or not. And this, again, pulls a lot of attention. A lot of people who were involved in the conquest have to go back towards the center and fight what ends up being, more than a decade-long struggle over the succession of the caliphate. At this time, one of the things you find in these kind of distant provinces that are very remote from the political centers is that the Arab authorities who stuck around could act with a lot of independence. And you have figures like Abdullah ibn Qasim, who I write quite a bit about here, who seizes the governorship of Khorasan by force, and finds himself fighting with his fellow Arabs over control of the province. This kind of push to consolidate his own authority in a period of kind of larger political insecurity obviously is detrimental to expanding the frontiers and conquering further. And this is where you get, Nick, you brought up Abdullah's son, Musa, who towards the end of the second fitna is said to have grabbed the treasury of Marv and fled to Sogdiana looking for help, and eventually conquers the city of Termez, a very important crossing point between on the Oxus in northern Tukharistan, and ends up kind of setting up a kingdom outside the reach of the empire for about a dozen years. So this is a story that kind of keeps going on throughout the Umayyad period. There's a lot of conflict between different Arab tribal groupings, different rivalries over positions of political authority, access to spoils, things like this, which challenge conquests and challenge the kind of political order that the empire is trying to establish here on the distant frontier.
And this leaves a kind of lasting impact on the region as a whole. But eventually the Umayyads do more or less take control, at least of these urban centers, right? They make it all the way to Sogdiana. I'm not sure what their presence is like in Tukharistan or whether or not they kind of rule through vassals or what. But by the end of their rule, even as all of these kind of revolts are going on, they do get a stronger footing in the region. Is that right?
It comes and goes, right? Throughout the, say, early 8th century. But the most interesting thing is that their authority is always kind of contested in this region, even among the Arabs. So it ends up being in the mid-8th century that the revolution that ends up overthrowing the Umayyads and brings the Abbasids to power begins in Khorasan, building out of these kind of animosities towards certain aspects of Umayyad rule.
And what kind of impact does this leave on the center? In a lot of modern history, especially when we're looking at kind of the decline of empires or even the struggle of empires on the edge, we see that this automatically ends up coming back to the center and kind of haunting it in a way. Do we see something similar happening in Baghdad? And also, what does this tell us about maybe center-periphery relations in the Umayyad Empire, or about center-periphery relations just in general?
So in the book, I've tried to focus more on the narrative of what's happening in these frontier regions. But the reality is that a lot of these kind of frontier populations and the kind of issues they bring with them end up becoming the center in the Abbasid era. So after the Abbasid revolution, the army that brought them to power is coming from the east. So when Baghdad is built, a lot of people from Khorasan and from Tukharistan and Transoxiana find their way into the centers of imperial power, right? That they are relocated to Iraq and they gain great positions of authority. For example, one of the most famous families of advisors to the caliphs, the Barmakids, are originally from Balkh. They were the caretakers of a Buddhist shrine there in Tukharistan. Later on, when there's an Abbasid civil war at the beginning of the 9th century, the empire does kind of divide again between Iraq and Khorasan. And it's the Khorasani candidate, al-Makmun, who ends up winning a victory again. And once again, you have a transfer of people from the east who come to the centers of power in Iraq for a time. So these issues do kind of, you do see at some point a movement of people from the east back towards that political center at these crucial moments.
And does that echo the experience of this, whether it's the Sasanians or the Umayyads in general, as they move further east? Is this a recurring pattern that we see, or is this something unique about the eastern frontier?
I think in the way it develops in the Abbasid period, it is fairly unique in the way that these people from the east are coming on a regular basis to become to the political center. And it's accelerated in a certain way in the Abbasid era, for example, by the employment of Turkish slave soldiers who are being brought from this frontier to the political center to become an the kind of core of an Abbasid military. We don't see a similar kind of movement, for example, of large numbers of people coming from other, kind of stretches of the empire in the same kind of way. But you do see a lot of mobility, especially among elites. So you can follow governors, for example, who are relocated to kind of different provinces with some set of regularity.
I'm glad you brought up the question of the Abbasid Revolution, because as far as I can tell, this is kind of one of the more compelling parts of the book, because you show that by looking at the frontier with this kind of focused lens, that suddenly the Abbasid Revolution, which is plays a huge role in the history of the region, is not this kind of isolated event, but rather fits into the general trend of revolt that was happening at that time. Could you talk more to that and give us some insight into what's new about your take on the Abbasid Revolution, and how do you differentiate yourself from kind of more traditional historiographical takes on the Abbasid Revolution?
So a lot of the scholarship that's been done on, say, early Islamic Khorasan, a lot of the focus has been about this question of the Abbasid Revolution. Who made up the army? Who was the kind of constituency that this revolutionary movement was talking to? What were the motivations? What were the specific grievances? And a lot of it comes down to fights about whether or not the Abbasid revolutionary movement was primarily disgruntled Arabs or disgruntled Iranians or some kind of mix, right? And how specifically they were working together. So one thing I did here was to kind of take a step back and in the chapter kind of on the revolution, I talk about a lot of this kind of historiography and the major themes, the major trends that have been there over the decades. But then want to take a step back and look at a number of revolts that are happening before and after it, or maybe not revolts, rebellions, disturbances in the region that are happening around it, and trying to situate the Abbasid Revolution in this context. So what you find when you look more broadly at these revolts is that very often we can't think of people kind of joining up because of these type of identity issues. They're not Arab revolts. They're not Iranian revolts. They're not Muslim revolts versus non-Muslim revolts. You find a lot of kind of fluidity and a lot of movement. And this is where maybe you see the closest thing to this kind of what we expect to see in a frontier situation of people of different diverse backgrounds living in close proximity, coming to have some shared interests and shared ideas. So looking at these kind of revolutions more broadly, that it makes it even harder to, in a sense, point the finger at one group and saying they're the ones who wanted to overthrow the Umayyads. No, it's probably easier to point a finger at one group and say they probably didn't want, everybody else did, in a sense.
And so is this experience of kind of, for lack of a better term, regime change in the capital, is your argument that this is ultimately leading to a more unified identity on the periphery? Is this when we start to see something that we can call like the culture of Islamic Central Asia, or is it still a bit too early to identify that?
So in the Abbasid era, you finally have this idea of a greater Khorasan developing, of Khorasan, Tokharistan, and Transoxiana together as a kind of administrative space. And where it really kind of formulates is in the development of these autonomous provincial dynasties in the 9th century. The first being the Tahririds being a family of most likely Arabized Iranians, who were very close with the Abbasid movement from the beginning and held important positions in Abbasid Khorasan. They are granted a kind of a autonomous governorship over the entire region. After they are defeated and removed from power by a movement coming out of Sistan known as the Safarids, the Samanids come in and kind of take over this role of ruling Greater Khorasan. And the Samanids are associated with this return to Iranian rule. It's under the Samanids that New Persian emerges as a language of the court and a language of government, that things like the Shahnameh are being produced, that a kind of Islamic Iranian identity is being formulated at the kind of upper levels of rulership. Okay. Part of my argument here is that the experience of the Arab conquests and the early Abbasid era in bringing what were very distinct regions together, right, under a shared political, cultural, religious identity over time, it creates a new kind of cultural political identity. Sorry if I'm rambling a little bit here. I'm kind of working these things out right now as we're talking. And one of the arguments I'd like to kind of push even further, and I'm trying to kind of formulate this out now in some other projects, is that what the Samanids, for example, bring is not necessarily a return to an older idea of Iranian kingship, but they are producing something new that's distinctly Islamic Iranian, right? They are replacing older political authorities that had kind of weathered the initial Arab conquests. Groups, for example, like the Bukhar Khudas in Bukhara, they lose their political authority sometime around the rise of the Samanids, right? That this is when they kind of disappear from the scene. And the Samanids make Bukhara their capital. So this is the kind of, in my sense, a culmination. The Samanids are not a kind of return to Iranian kingship, but the culmination of the kind of conquest process.
And so is this where do we get this narrative about the Samanids returning to an older style of Iranian rule? Is this the Samanids themselves pushing this narrative in order to legitimize their rule, or is something else happening?
Well, if we look at the court culture, they definitely were embracing a local Iranian identity, right? They bring Persian back as a language of the court and of literature and culture. They promote the translation of many texts from Arabic into Persian, things like this. They have a most likely fabricated genealogy that connects them back to the Sasanian emperors. These type of things there's definitely more of a promotion of a Iranian identity. But I think the crucial thing is that in the context of Sogdiana, Tokaristan, of Khorasan, it's not necessarily the local culture entirely, right? It's one that's being constructed and being in response to the kind of recent political history, the Islamization of the region. A number of factors kind of playing out here.
And it seems like we can't ignore the fact that, the caliphate itself, or sorry, the Abbasid caliphate is also moving forward in the frontier during this time. How can we explain their relative success, especially if we're looking in relation to their successors in the region? Is it because these new dynasties are propping up? I mean, where's the cause and effect here? Or is it because they themselves have foundations on the frontier? Does this somehow make them more capable to expand into the region?
Yeah, early on, the Abbasids are able to make kind of great expansions. So the Abbasids come to power in 750, and 751 is the kind of famous Battle of Talas, in which an Abbasid army faces off against a army of the Tang Empire of China, or representatives of both sides. There's possibilities that this is a proxy battle, right? So this is that there's a huge kind of leap forward initially. By the Samanid period, that dynamic is changing quite a bit. So you'll see in my book, for example, I spent a lot of time talking about the kind of rise of the Turkic military class within the Samanid Empire, right? And the competition between a local Iranian, for lack of a better term, nobility, people who could claim to have kind of political authority going back all the way to the pre-Islamic period, on the local level, finding their positions being given over to this new Turkic military elite. And this grows a kind of a competition, and eventually the downfall of the Samanids, they find themselves in a vice between the Ghaznavids, who started off as their Turkish slave soldiers, set up a state in modern Afghanistan, and then the Karakhanids, Turkic people coming down from the steppe who had supposedly converted to Islam on their own, not as a result of conquest, but of their own volition, and they come in and end up conquering the kind of Transoxianan part of the Samanid Empire. So the frontier really does collapse in the Samanid period, at the end of the Samanid period, and then from there, it's not long before the Seljuks are going to come down and completely kind of sweep across Iran and Iraq and most of the Muslim world.
And prior to the fall of the Samanids, what kind of relationship did they have with the empire more generally? Are they able to succeed so quickly because of their kind of position on the edge of the empire? How does the empire force them to pay some kind of tribute? Are they even able to? Prior to the Karakhanids coming down south.
Well, the Abbasids were in a pretty bad position by the time the Samanids came to power. The caliphs themselves had become little more than kind of figureheads in many ways, and much of their authority had been taken over by their military class. And the Samanids' biggest rivals in Iran, for example, are the Buyids, who were from Dalem, Dalemites from the kind of southwestern coast of the Caspian Sea, who had come and conquered Baghdad along with most of western Iran, and also had kind of made a claim to this kind of pre-Islamic Iranian form of kingship, right? For example, the Buyids employ the title Shah and Shah in a way that the Samanids don't. So there's not a lot that the Abbasids could really do about controlling this frontier without a group like the Samanids. That being said, the Samanids did use, in their kind of political imagining of themselves, this claim to be supported and authorized by the Abbasids, as part of their kind of propaganda. So they would recognize the Abbasids in their, when it was appropriate, they would maybe occasionally send some tribute back, but nothing quite like regular taxation. And they would at times claim to be acting in the Abbasids' authority. But really, at that point, it's kind of meaningless. The Abbasids didn't have much of anything to offer by way of support.
And so when the Karakhanids finally capture a great part of the former Samanid Empire, you mentioned that the border itself, the frontier, collapses. What happens? I mean, surely there has to be a new balance that emerges. What does that look like?
Well, temporarily, the frontier goes back to the Oxus, with the Karakhanids ruling in Transoxiana and the Ghaznavids ruling below that in Khorasan and Tokharistan. But by that point, it's kind of the movement on the frontier has shifted direction, that it is no longer the caliphate or representatives of an empire whose heart is in kind of greater Iran, pushing further out into Central Asia. It is now, political organizations that are forming on the steppe that are pushing south. So the Karakhanids and Ghaznavids will be removed by the Seljuks, as I mentioned before. And from here on out, that's the kind of trajectory that has changed. So the flow on the frontier of political and military authority has switched direction.
And so if we consider everything that we've kind of discussed in the last half hour or so, I want to bring this back to the kind of point of the book, which is about the geographical nature of this region, the ethno-linguistic nature of this region, and coming back to that word shatter zone. So what kind of takeaway should the reader get when they're reading this book? And I'm wondering what this tells us about frontiers in general, or if we can say something more conclusive about Central Asia, especially as we look at this kind of span of 5 or 6 centuries of frontier relations.
I think the biggest takeaway is that we should be very wary about any kind of simplistic narrative of the Arab Islamic conquests. Anything that puts these these events in, for example, in binary terms of, for example, the caliphate conquering and replacing the Sasanian Empire, or view it as a competition of Arabs versus Iranians, for example. When we get to a place like Central Asia, and this idea of the kind of shatter zone, an area where you have a lot of regions that are internally divided, that are difficult to access, that are in a lot of ways disconnected from each other. That diversity is seen even more clearly, and the preservation of it is seen even more clearly. So that these identities that really even the medieval chroniclers, kind of lump everyone together as, Turks, for example, I think in the Great Chronicle of Tabari, there's, I believe, one reference to Hephthalites, even though we know a lot of times when he's saying Turk, he means a Hephthalite. These groups were able to kind of survive, and that their impact on the development of, a kind of Islamic Central Asian culture, identity, political structure is very meaningful, right? And we shouldn't just think about this as a single narrative, but a bunch of smaller narratives that each had their own kind of timeline and trajectory and results.
And so now we're nearing the end of the interview. We've taken up quite a bit of your time, but I wanted to ask, one more question. Now that you have this kind of framework to work on, looking at the Eastern frontier, are you going to continue this project, or do you have any other research projects in mind?
I think I'm never going to fully walk away from this frontier, and I have a number of things coming out and projects that are working on different aspects of this that maybe couldn't fit entirely in the book. So, for example, I've got a couple pieces coming out where I'm looking a little bit to the west, to the area of Tabaristan, which is just to the south of the Caspian Sea, and shared a lot of kind of similar issues and history with early Islamic Khorasan. But as far as my next big project, my next major project, while I was working on this, I got very interested in questions of how these narratives of the Islamic conquests came to be recorded, came to be structured the way they are. And some that really were important to me or you know, kind of impacted me were the stories of characters like Abdullah ibn Qasim and his son Musa, which I would categorize as kind of adventure stories. These were accounts that, compared to other aspects of the conquest, there were more detail. There was more kind of life to them. There was a sense of, you know, adventure to them. If you go through and, for example, read the accounts of Musa going into Transoxiana and going to Bukhara and Samarkand and these places looking for help, they're very exciting stories to read compared to what you find in most of the rest of the conquest literature. So my current project is to kind of look at some of these tales, study how they were kind of transmitted, where they're coming from, how they end up in the texts where they have been preserved, and really think about the message they are constructing. And right now I'm looking at this more so thinking about how images of like masculinity are constructed in the medieval Arabic chronicles, how the ideals of, say, heroes and villains are constructed, because these figures in particular go back and forth from being, you know, important figures who conquered important places in the name of the caliphate, and then turn into rebels who are turned on their fellow Arabs and run away, run off beyond the reach of the caliphate. So that's the project I'm going on now, is getting into more of a kind of historiographical project for the time being.
Well, that sounds like a really fascinating project, and I'm sure we'll definitely look forward to seeing that. It sounds like a great compliment to the work that you've already done. And Rob, I wanted to just thank you again for coming on the show today and talking about your book, which, once again, for the listeners, is The Eastern Frontier, Limits of Empire in Late Antique and Early Medieval Central Asia, which just came out with IB Taurus. So thanks again, Rob. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Nick. Thank you for inviting me, and it was a pleasure talking with you.